If it's Sunday, it's the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
I am still Mark Marbella.
Awesome. Wearing a Brooklyn Brewery t-shirt, I see. I was, Garrett Oliver was on the board of directors, if Renato remembers. We have our special guests here.
Well, the show, I thought I'd wear, sporting my Brooklyn Brewery, my favorite shirt. Can't wear it many places because it's kind of getting a little raggy.
But, and Steve Hindi, who should be on the network one day, especially now, I feel like I need to be nice to everybody.
I don't know him or anything. We just interviewed him, but
he was an interesting cat. He was, I think, a foreign correspondent. Yeah, it's a great story. Middle East or something.
It's a great story.
And you met him out at the Producers Guild?
No, we met him at we were doing a interview for IBM actually, because all these small companies who have done used IBM in their software. Brooklyn Brewery being one of them, and he just told about his story, which is fantastic. But that's perhaps for next week. Microbrewing libations. This week is about Fresh Eats, and we have some fantastic guests with us here in the studio and coming up. We have Renato and Anya.
Renato Sardo and Anya Fernanda. I mean, Renato was my last boss at the international office. I mean, he was the founder of it. And then he left to go do other things, like I think invest in Wall Street and Milan. And then they were like,
"We were there to send them back." So I may have met them when I was in Bra, because I visited when
you came out to a wedding.
That's right. Were they there?
I was not Anya.
No. At the time, actually, I was just joining Back Slow Food. I worked first in 95 and 96, and then I jumped back in. Late 99.
I was the guy hovering over the Parmesan wheel at the wedding. That was me with all that stuff on my chin. So
you proposed to your wife at that same.
Oh my goodness!
That's right. Actually, that's amazing.
And now she's outside, 6 months pregnant
with a child.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
With a daughter. Very exciting.
Well, we're so honored to have Renato and Anya. Anya is also, among other things, we were talking a little bit about before, but she is she was the organizer of Slow Food Nation, which was the number one event that Slow Food's ever had in the States. And
that was amazing. I mean, this past one in San Francisco? Yeah. Oh, that was fantastic. I'm so glad we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Well, the theme that we wanted to talk about, Renato was talking like Farmers Markets 2.0. Future steps.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your guys' works and your thoughts.
The thought is that I think that farmers market have incredible, wonderful expansion in the last 10, 15 years. And now, at least in California and in the West Coast, we are on a phase where the classical expansion, I mean, they have to rethink a little bit their model, simply because it's a success sort of dilemma. But I think that the way they have to think what next. So I think it could be that's why I proposed this theme. I think that
what's the answer to that? What is next?
Well, we don't know exactly. I think the farmers market is probably in California around 3-4% of the total sales on produce, so it's still pretty minimal. It's even lower than
that. You mean less than 3% of produce consumed
is bought at the farmers market?
Really?
And that's California, which is the highest percentage. I just know this data because I was in a very boring meeting.
Does that mean what's local too? Would that qualify?
No,
3%?
No. In the you have to add to those. To that 3% also, basically some groceries, like some Whole Foods or some of the groceries.
They might still buy locally.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Some of them buy locally. And that's probably another 7 to 10%. Mm-hmm. So we are still talking. So there is, in terms of numbers, there is a lot of space to growth. But what's limiting a little bit the growth of farmers market is mostly now that some of the farmers are a stretched thin, in the sense that they are already busy in many farmers market, and there is a little bit of lagging between the demand for new farmers market and what the farmers can do. So there is definitely the need, at least in California, to try to involve in this farmers market movement new slightly larger farmers. There is the need to find more people to go back to the farms, and we see something happening in California. But there is also the need for farmers market to differentiate themselves a little bit and to add and to be more careful in selecting, for example, the street food that they are offering.
Right.
And that's probably Anya can talk a little bit about that, because there is an event that will be staged in Auckland in August that will mark a little bit the new kind of farmers market, where the street food will be a highly component to recruit more customers there.
So Anya, tell us about that. Like, is that the new thing? I mean, farmers markets could grow through street vending. I mean, through the traditional foods.
Through prepared foods. Yeah, I mean, I think there's two axes of kind of potential development. One is street food and the other is artisan food. Another kind of big possibility is helping use farmers markets as a platform for hard to engage in direct marketing, like CSAs and facilitated purchasing. So the event that we're doing, the Eat Real Festival, is a gathering of 40 street food vendors, all of which are using at least one locally sourced sustainable ingredient.
Right. We're talking mostly about taco trucks, so not fancy.
And just for our audience who may not know, we're going to have some people who are participating in alternative community gardens and CSAs later in the show, and also farmers market here in Brooklyn, Travis Tench. Can you tell us what a CSA is exactly? Just sort of define it for us. What is a CSA for people who don't know?
CSA means community supported agriculture, and it's basically a means to buy direct from a farm in the form of a diversified box of locally sourced produce, mostly from one farm, but then there's also CSAs where you can get a box from a lot of different farms. So they range from a farm that you can actually purchase the year before a share for the entire year, or in the other end of the gamut would be a box that arrives from a group of different farms that's selected for something like, let's say, fruit that you can eat right out of the box. So there's a early adopter version, and then there's definitely a much simpler version out there. So CSA is kind of a broad category that refers to food in boxes, and traditionally meant something
interesting.
A bit more.
And we're going to have people from different states, actually, one from Massachusetts, one from New Mexico. It sounds like you guys are talking about sort of the next level, which is really interesting and fantastic, of expanding sort of, you know, beyond the kind of family farmer market, the millers selling their tomatoes at the roadside, to sort of larger, maybe mid-sized agriculture to sort of supply. I mean, the problem is pretty good, frankly, that, you know, you have to expand. The demand is so high. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's an exciting... I mean, some of the farmers...
Good problem to have, right?
Yeah, there is. That's also where, I mean, small farmers, especially in California, where it's pretty easy to have to grow different varieties in a small acre, and you have long seasons, so you can take advantage of farmers market for basically three quarters of the year, and that's, I mean, it can happen, frankly, just in California and in a few other states. So that's The small, very small farmers who can differentiate a lot their production can take full advantage of the farmers market opportunity or the CSAs. But let's take most about the
farmers market. Difference? What's the difference for people who don't know between CSA and a farmers market?
Well, the CSAs probably take practically, it's even better for farmers because it takes off the risk from the table.
If they can you deliver have, broccoli every week.
Yeah.
And
but for example, if you buy in advance, whatever the farmers can get you, if the farmers get torrential rains and his crop is ruined, I mean, part of his loss, most of his loss are distributed among the consumers who subscribe the CSA.
It's like getting a newspaper subscription compared to buying at the newsstand.
I see. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Yeah, that's pretty clear.
The medium-sized farmers market, who generally work more on volume, the medium-sized farmers, generally have less varietals, and so they need to sell more of fewer crops, and those are the ones who cannot take advantage
of volume,
farmers market.
Right. It's about volume, right?
Yeah. Because they're not so spectacular to have a stand next to a guy that has 30 types of fingerling.
They have mostly like tomatoes or...
radicchio?
Yeah, let's say tomatoes or radicchio, and they cannot, you know, they need to sell a lot of it. They are kind of specialized on these fewer specialties, and the farmers market, they sell too little to take any to make sense for them.
So what's the solution for those
the
people?
The solution is probably to find we don't know yet exactly, but I think that it has to come from sort of permanent public markets, and that's one of the areas where we are I'm working actually on. I mean, I'm working in Auckland to open a new big public market similar to Pike's Place, like just to, in Seattle, just to give an idea.
And that's one component of the bigger downtown Oakland redevelopment that you've been working on for a few years, right?
Yes, that's one of the key components. Then one could be having, I mean, probably go through cooperatives and having the association of, I don't know, tomato growers from a certain county in California and running stands at the farmer's market or running tables in permanent market.
I'm sorry, Renato, we have a call-in on the line.
Fantastic.
Oh, wow. So, patch him in. Hello?
Hey, is this Patrick?
Yes.
Hey, Patrick, it's Heather. I have a question for Renato.
Oh, of course, Heather. Fire away.
We were just sitting here listening to the show and wondering, you know, if you have a CSA in one area, if the vegetables may be different in a CSA from one side of the country to another, and if there is any benefit to farmers to try and set up something where they will maybe be able to, you know, FedEx their offerings for the week, you know, across the country to try and help them move more of their product.
Yeah, it
is
could
that
be.
Kind of going
be.
Against the CSA?
A little bit. It goes, not really. It goes, I think, I mean, maybe I could... Anya did more work in direct sales with farmers, but I think it goes a little bit against the general philosophy, which is the general philosophy that has generated the CSAs, which was basically support your local farmers, subscribe them. If local farmers start to sell all over the country, you know, in the end, you would end up being best served by some distributors who does that more professionally. And so you would reinvent a wheel. So the CSA was mostly done as a direct way to save your direct farmers, your local farmer. There could be on some specialties, like for example, on avocados from San Diego, there could be a scope. I would like to start a CSA with Parmigiano Reggiano from Italy because I don't get any good one here. I don't know exactly why. But.
Interesting.
I would too, actually.
So, Anya, how important is the local movement to your work? I mean, is the goal to regionalize, to localize, or is it just to phase out industrial practices? I mean, it seems like a lot of what you guys have been talking about today is bordering that farmers market 2.0, like from 1.0 to 2.0. So, like, how do you embrace the local and the size of the farmer and the anyway?
I mean, I feel like there's not, I don't feel as much of a need to put rigorous boundaries. And I think that the things like 100-mile local diet, the 200-mile local diet, those are all the early phases that the movement's going to evolve away from. Because really, what do people look for? Why are they getting into being enthusiastic about local food? I think they want connections with who makes their food. That has part
of
it.
Absolutely.
It's safety. Like, I want to know where it comes from because I want my kids to be safe and me to be safe. Part of it's better quality.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is, I want to have that human connection. And if we look at Farmers Market 2.0, if we try to get to what do people want? What do the individuals go? I mean, a lot of people don't get any place to meet their neighbors if they don't go to a farmer's market.
Right.
So if you're looking to what's going to be, and I definitely agree with Renato that some of the next models can also be about the consortia, the different, you know, needs of the farmers. But really, it's going to be the needs in the long term of the consumers that drive it. And I think that consumers are hungry for more traceability, more community, and a greater sense of connection to their food.
Well, if I can for a minute, we're going to have the Bushwick gentleman in shortly.
Farmers Market.
Bushwick Farmers Market. But I can speak to living in Brooklyn. We have, my wife and I live between two farmers markets, and everything you're talking about, we enjoy in that way. You know, we have, it's accountability. We can talk to the farmer. She can plan a meal in some cases where they're going to do like, hey, I have something coming online and heavy cream, goat cream if she needs that, or you know, we're looking for zucchini flowers for a particular recipe, etc. It's pretty interesting, and what Renato was saying before about particular eats and sort of fingerling as part of sort of the draw, but it is very communal too. You know, they know her, and how great is it to be able to talk to the people who are actually growing your food, picking it, literally bringing it on the truck. I mean, it just seems
obvious. Street vendors for that. I mean, like, I used to have a Sabret stand, a hot dog stand. He was a real fixture in the neighborhood back in the early 70s. And he was producing like mediocre industrial hot dogs, but it was still pretty delicious.
He's responsible for his fare is the point.
Yeah. I mean, tell us about this whole street food. Why street food? Where's the potential of it? And where are these street food traditions? Like, why street food? Tell us about that. I find that very interesting. The Union Square Market, by the way, does not allow any food.
Really?
So ridiculous. Huh. Really? I mean, because they were always afraid of hurting the local businesses, which, by the way, was always one city bakery.
Yeah,
because
I've gotten... They get pies and stuff here, don't they?
Oh, I mean, prepared foods. Like, you can't get... Like, in San Francisco, you could choose from 8 places to have lunch.
Oh, I see.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. There's no lunch
there. I mean, this is like a pie. Or, and they don't want to compete with local businesses, which is now Whole Foods
and ironically, the local businesses are thriving because of the market.
Exactly.
Because the restaurants around there are getting... Their produce from that market.
You get a whole different demo when you have the street food because who's going to come then? People who go to farmers markets are like people who know to cook in season, et cetera. Mm-hmm. If you start to say, okay, you can get a snack, and also people with families, okay, I want to have something where I can give the kids when I'm shopping.
Right.
But the key is going to be to build the bridge. I mean, that's the farmers market 2.0 vision is saying every street food vendor has to have one product from this market in their, and it, maybe it's just the radish on the side of the taco. Like maybe it's something almost symbolic and it can grow into more. But with the event that we're doing, we've actually made an obligation for them to source something locally for the Eat Real Festival for all the taco trucks. And they have no problem. You just got to ask them and tell them that they can charge a higher price for it. We're making the cap on all the food that we serve as $5 and the event is free to make it as accessible as possible.
Interesting.
But, you know, to do that, we're saying if you need help finding, you know, trying to focus on protein, on good quality meat, because that's the biggest, I think, you know, biggest for me, the biggest block for me eating more street food is just that I'm scared of some of the meat that they use.
Street meat.
Street meat. It's
we sketchy. Worked with a guy named Simon at Tilt 23 and a half, and Simon kept saying that every time we would go to the doctor, our first question is, have you eaten street meat in the past 2 weeks? Because that's probably why you're sick. Very interesting. And are they all like, I don't want to say third world, but I mean, are there American U.S. street food traditions or do they all come from like... you know, kebabs, and I mean, where
Manila, there's a, I mean, in Philippines, there's a huge amount of street meat. I mean, and some of the best. I mean, in New York, there's a great, I mean,
barbecue street meat.
The barbecue, but I was going to say in New York City, there used to be ironically fresh seafood. I mean, oysters of all things, in the street, like fresh, literally caught out of the, out of the shoals, which is hysterical to think about now. But I mean, that was, that was street meat. And now it's sort of fine dining, right? I mean, it's very pricey and, actually, I don't know how much more time we have in this segment, but
We have about 3 more minutes.
I wanted to, if you guys, I know you guys have were on the previous show, but if you could just, for our listeners, just kind of back up a bit and tell us a little bit about your sort of, you know, the auspices of Slow Food and, you know, what it's about and the regions and what it all means. I mean, define, what is Slow Food at this point? I mean, there's so much to talk about if you can sort of wrap it into a... Short.
Renata's eating
you have
pizza.
You have a short
so I'm gonna,
version. Yeah. I'm sorry, Renata. You can. Anya, I thought Anya could do it.
I can do it. Yeah, sure. Then you can.
You've heard it enough. Anya. Yeah.
So Slow Food is historically was a movement for the right to the pleasures of the table, to defend the rights of the pleasures of the table, and it has expanded from that to be a global movement with a broad set of objectives that include, you know, everything related to the backstory behind this defense of the table, and those include things like the biodiversity, the food supply, social justice, and in food equity issues,
communal
eating,
familial,
bringing food back to the center of the table.
Right.
So, you know, and I think that Slow Food has taken on a very different character in every country that it operates in, and I had the privilege of working in a lot of developing countries doing slow food projects in South America and Africa and Asia. And their slow food was just the way that they ate. And our challenge was just to provide sort of, I say, put some gloss and some appeal on what they were already doing to help them think more in a bigger picture way about adopting some American practices sort of full on. So people, you know, in India are so eager to adopt a lot of aspects of industrial production, industrial eating, and trying to show them, okay, well, actually the traditional way. And that's clearly something that an external group from another country can only do to a limited amount, I think. But, you know, the goal was to say, let's raise the profile of these heritage artisan ways of being that are actually healthier for communities and individuals and for the planet.
I think that makes... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, just to add, I think that Slow Food in Italy had a very important role, which was really to give value to the heritage food that Italy had. Mm. That in the early... Now it seems like almost obvious, but in the 80s...
That's a very interesting point,
actually.
In the
80s, basically, all whatever was regarded was attached... traditional food was really not trendy and boring. And Slow Foods... there was even a movement of youth that was called the paninari that were eaten in McDonald's, and that was considered as cool and progressive. So Slow Food say, you know, we have to protect our heritage. It's very important, and every country does that.
Even the bread traditions were diminishing in Italy.
All the salu, like
it's horrible to say
that. But Slow Food became an authority in representing the Italian gastronomic heritage. That's why it's so credible in Italy when it switched to other areas, like the ecology first, now the social. In US, I have to say, Slow Food hasn't had the time to become an authority on the sort of more foodie side, mm-hmm. and that penalizes it a little bit, I think, because now it's not yet clear exactly what it stands for.
I'll tell you one thing. We once had this conversation. I don't know if you still believe it. Presidia. 100%. That's what they should be doing. They should get their hands dirty, and they should be doing Presidia like Anya did, like we tried to do with the Turkey Project. That's an
Presidia, intervention. Define it for the listeners, Patrick.
Presidia, basically, it's Slow Food did this arc, which is the metaphor, realized that basically most of the typical products, the vegetable varieties that are lost under threat of extinction because basically of the way distribution works and the way agriculture has been industrialized. So we are using less and less varieties of anything. So we are losing biodiversity. So Slow Food first has done the Arc of Taste, which was a list of all the products that are under threat of extinction, and in some cases has created actions around this product to protect them and to revive them. And that's what in Italy is called Presidia. We never find the right name in English. Presidio means garrison, means action somehow. Mm. And in English, we never find a very good name.
Well, Anya, when we come back, are we close to break?
This might be our final second, because they're doing a culinary tour of Queens.
We're going to hit some street food here.
Wow, that's a great, Roosevelt Avenue, that is the place that you can...
Yeah.
Oh, man, that is a great spot. Yeah, you can go. It's all like a lot of Southeast Asian and South Asian.
Exactly. So a friend of ours is taking on us.
Mark, come to dinner with us on Tuesday night. Renato and I are going to have dinner. Maybe we could go check out some wild street food scene.
I would love to.
I would like to try Minettas because I just read, I think it's very interesting that it's very cheap. And then the hamburger is very expensive. And I think that's the future.
Yes.
That's the future.
By the way, Anya, when you talked to me about this whole cow, if the farmers could... I mean, the best food value for a chef is the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that he could pay $7 a pound for. So they could ground up all the ground into grind. I mean, I say, if you have trouble moving your whole cattle, grind the entire thing in the ground.
Interesting.
Keep the ribeye. Ground the tenderloin.
Oh my God!
I mean, ground it all.
This is blaspheme, isn't it?
No, but you can make. You can charge $7 a pound. That's $3 a portion for a burger that should go, as Renato says, for $20.
Here we are. We're at Burgers. We're in America. Anya is clearly American. I want to hear why is there pushback here in America? What's happening with Slow Food? It's distinct here. What's going on? I mean, it's Patrick, of course, brought it here and sort of has been yapping
amongst
about it for
other people.
Yeah, has been yapping about it for however
including
long.
Renato
with Alice and Renato. But what's going on here? What's the American psyche of the burger and et cetera?
You mean why is there?
There seems to be pushback. I mean, meaning I am
elitism?
Somebody. I have no axe to grind. From a science background, it's interesting. You talk. My interest in slow food is sort of biodiversity and of course flavor. I have Italian heritage. It was all about sort of slow food and eating in big family meals and all that. That makes sense, but. In the U.S., there's always this pushback. Why wouldn't you want to eat fresh food from the farmer?
Yeah, and why is that all of a sudden a privilege?
Why is that somehow?
Well, I have like my conspiracy self where I feel like, okay, 40 years ago, everybody ate slow food. If you were poor, you had a garden. Why is it that now, when you're rich, you can afford to have a garden?
Yeah.
And why is it that things like, I do a canning project, I have a canning program called Yes We Can Food, which is all about doing these.
My mother, my grandmother, everybody canned.
But
everybody canned.
We're trying to talk about how this used to be everybody's skill, and now it's something that's become very frou-frou and very fancy. And I just don't understand...
Yeah, because Martha Stewart, it's like she's got to put a bow on it, right? It's not. It wasn't about that.
That's what we want. All right. Sorry. I overdo it on the sound effects board once a Sunday.
But I don't really understand the transition that happened in those three or four decades where these very, very mainstream attributes became all of a sudden a privilege of the elite. So part
the
of why
elite
I think,
became Republicans. All these Democrats from Northern California are trickle-down Republicans. And when I tried to run...
I perfectly agree. Well, the epicenter is Marin County. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Well, I don't know. You should
don't
have
you have
some
a button for Marin County there?
Yes, I have. How's this? Wait, from Marin County.
Marin County. Yeah. Well, everything is a win-win. Like, from the high of the billion of dollars that they have earned through logging, mostly. or some other bad, nasty extractive industry. Oh, now they teach you the win-win.
Win-win. No, it's
I
true.
I don't think this is about Marin County. I think
no, but Northern California is always with slow food. The Northern California...
They've been doing it for a long time.
They judge their situation to be that of the national situation. Those guys in Kansas and Missouri and Arkansas had very different situations than in Berkeley.
No, that's
and
true.
By the way, Alice, I do not mean to imply everyone is always dissing Alice. I always wonder why, of all people, everyone needs to hammer.
She is big great. Threat, right? Yeah. Big threat to food. Of all, I mean, like, she just only makes, like, the best.
But can we talk about the fact that there have been billions of dollars spent by fast food to make us think that this is the food of the people, and your home garden food is the food of the elite. I mean, to be a little bit of a conspiracy theorist here, I don't think that anybody's to blame in terms of Northern California, et cetera. There's been lots and lots of money spent to make us think that's you know, really nasty fast food is the feed of the people. Mm-hmm. And we've bought that, you know, but there's no reason why. I mean, who's the marketing dollar for grass-fed meat? Who's the marketing dollar? I mean, where is that money coming from? There is no agency. There is no advocacy group. There is no equivalent counteractive force. And so we've gone totally the way, and we've believed everything they've told us.
Well, as Patrick says, I mean, you know, it's amazing that it's funny that they should think that that's a threat with all their with all their marketing.
3% of San Francisco.
I was so happy to see your event in San Francisco. It was fantastic. It was well attended. It was the biggest of, you know, in America.
So much fun.
It was fantastic.
I wish that weekend never ended. I mean, we had so much fun, and we were working a lot.
But return wasn't. I thought that Obama had a chance to win when he was forced himself to eat hot dogs and hamburgers to show that that's the way. I mean. Because before
maybe Michelle.
And then,
but do you remember some of the press about Obama saying he drinks on his tea, which isn't made with high fructose corn syrup, so he's kind of like an elitist? Because you don't drink high fructose corn syrup, you're a member of the elite, because you don't drink food made from the richest people in America. That makes you, I mean, that's nuts.
Are you tagging Jack? Just kidding. We're going like 10 minutes over because this conversation is so good. But it's also, I don't want
to
stop it. But Jack's like so pissed at us. He's like, I'm trying to keep this
organized. Jack is our producer who is trying to keep us on time to no avail.
I know. Could we order another pizza, Jack? Wait, no, scratch that. No, but it is. I mean, it's, you know, kind of how dare they. You know, there was that guy McWilliams that talked about how free-range pork is dangerous, you know, almost dare you.
Oh, yeah,
you know, there's really no acceptance of that. That's a form of racism against people barely making it. That's worse than hurting American Indians, really, because there are probably fewer free-range pork farmers. I mean, anyway, it's
well, except
we're fighting
for their land
battles.
Wasn't stolen, but that's a separate issue.
Well, with all of the crap out there and all of the talk.
Genocide, but yeah, I get
the except for the genocide and land stolen, exactly the same.
We could have a
and the conquest of virgin territory.
Free-range pork farmers
because you're on a great metaphor.
Well, no, but for all of the talkers out there who are 99% trash-talking, I have to say I have a tremendous respect for Renato and Anya, who always who never shied away from work and who always got stuff done. Slow Food Nation being one of the more recent total kick-ass events, and you know, I hope that Slow Food, Chefs Collaborative, any nonprofit, for-profit, takes as an example actual concrete results. You know, and I find that really admirable, and I'm big fans of you guys. So, thanks for being on. I hope you guys come back on again.
Any place where we get to drink cold Brooklyn Brewery lager during the interview, I'm down with.
Might be 6 Point.
Yeah, I think it's 6 Point, but nonetheless, it's still local.
Yeah, it's local.
Very good. Too.
Best pizza. This is something I'm telling you. This is some of the best pizza in New York City.
Last time we were here, I think they cooked us brains on a Bunsen burner, and it was awesome.
Brains on a Bunsen burner.
Stop talking about it. I'm getting hungry.
B&B. That's been trademarked by Bastiano Cimbatali. Sorry, you can't use that.
Or Bill Blass. I don't know.
Right. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining. Through the pouring rain, going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Northeast winds sailing on summer breeze and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
We're back at the Q Report. Wow, that was, we kind of lost track. As
we kind of got heated. That was the first time we ever, like, got, I don't know.
I'm bad. I'm yammering on, and, you know, they're like, we got to go. They're like, and it was fantastic, though.
It's Sunday, it's the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Mark Marabella.
Today, have we mentioned the sponsor yet?
No, and we need to.
Sam Edwards, the best prosciutto this side. He was just here for the Fancy Food Show. Very successful. We had a tasting of St. Bart's and local prosciutto 400 miles away. And
fantastic.
Speaking of local, we have a very local farmer's market.
Yeah, it's in our neighborhood, the neighborhood we're broadcasting from, which is Bushwick, Brooklyn. We have Travis Tench.
That's correct.
You know, I have a very good friend, Tench, although it's his first name, from Norfolk, Virginia, who had the local cinema, which I would have been dead without down there when I was living down there. But Tench is fantastic. Little shout out to Tench. I don't know.
There's no relation to Lady Dame Tench, or what's her name? Judy Dent? Tench?
Judy Dench. Oh, yeah. This is like 6 degrees.
But
Travis,
right?
This is so fantastic, and thank you so much for being here. I don't know if you heard the previous conversation with Renata and Anya, but we're talking about local food and Farmers Market 2.0. And part of the station and part of our mantra is to sort of do it yourself, kind of get up and how to. And it's just so amazing. I mean, just first of all, just for people who don't know, and people listen across the country, just describe Bushwick for people. Mm-hmm. What kind of neighborhood is it?
Where are we?
Tell us. You better than we've mentioned a lot on the show, but tell us about Bushwick just a bit, and then we talk about what it took to get the farmers market here.
Right. Bushwick is pretty industrial, I think, for the most part. A lot of warehouses, a lot of shipping, a lot of empty lots, a lot of rusting metal things around.
Not necessarily conducive. You don't think green when you think Bushwick.
No, definitely not. We're seeing that change. We're seeing a lot of these spaces being cleaned up and turned into gardens. Or if they were formerly green space of some kind with just weeds, then they were kind of renovated and compost brought in and replanted and
principally tell us. I mean, it is not just industrial, although it's principally and always was. It's zoned that way, but there is residential there. Tell us.
Yeah.
So the Bushwick is kind of large, kind of just after, for people who know Williamsburg. Maybe it's just after sort of Williamsburg to the east, towards the ocean, in the middle of. Close to the middle of Brooklyn. Who comprises the neighborhood, and how big is Bushwick?
Yeah, what ethnicities are here? I actually don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, there's a pretty good mix of people here in Bushwick. You kind of see a convergence of culture. I think a lot of much of Bushwick is Hispanic populations from Puerto Rico, from Mexico, from differing Central American countries. And then you also see a lot of the artist community here also. So it's sort of this, these mix of these different groups coming together. I think much of the residential places are it's pretty concrete. It's pretty a lot of impermeable surfaces here.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't think and we're, I don't know if this is the first time you've been to Roberta's. You knew where it was, but we have of course a garden growing on top of us, which again, industrial gardening, which we've talked about the show several times. But
you need an industrial district for Manhattan. I mean, of course, right. I mean, one trucker once asked me, name one thing that has not been on a truck. And right. You think about that. I mean, the only thing I've ever thought of is like water, you know, which probably comes in, and maybe a tree, you know. But I mean, almost everything. And where are all those warehouses? Long Island City, Bushwick, right. You know, Boar's Head plant.
Well, I mean, Brooklyn was classically Navy Yard, and mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about that. The industrialization. It was the industrial sector of Manhattan. You did have factories in Manhattan, but after a while, and you had farms in Brooklyn too, and in Manhattan. But now it's becoming more residential all the way, you know, to Bushwick and beyond, obviously.
And there's this urban renaissance, you know, and now it must be very hard to start a farmer's market or even, I mean, where do you even begin in a place that's defined
tell
as
us, like,
industry?
Idea one, you know, you're sitting there and you're like, you're hating your whatever you're eating, and why even do this? It must be such a hassle, right?
Well, why? Because we need it. I mean, because there isn't one. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, there is another one actually, also in that's incorrect. One in Maria Hernandez Park every Saturday as well,
which is close.
Yeah, it's also very close here.
Are you a member of the Green Market?
No, we're sponsored by we're through the Farmers Market Nutrition Program with the Department of Health. So not through Scenic Council on the Environment with Green Market.
So tell us about the market, the Bushwick Market. Where is it? How long is it? What days, etc. What's involved?
Every Wednesday from 10 to 6, and we're on Linden Street on the corner of Broadway. We're right out in front of the Linden Bushwick Block Association Garden, which is it's a beautiful garden with the space there facing Broadway and Linden, and then there's like the secret garden, they call it, in the back where everybody has their plots, and we're working on renovating part of it for a sort of nature reserve / education center, hopefully in the future. So there's some cleanup going on with that, and yeah, it's just this, you forget you're half a block from Broadway. So
it's amazing. So it is a partly community garden. Is that where the produce comes from? You have farmers coming in?
We have farmers coming in from upstate and out in the Long Island.
And which farmers are those? Like, many farmers go to the Green Market,
right,
or to, you know, there are a few other public markets. I know there's the Fort Greene Flea Market, which has some food vendors. Mm-hmm. So, like, are yours
different? Fort Greene Farmers Market, too, at Fort Greene Park.
Right.
Yeah.
So are yours, how are yours different? Or
do
are
you
they
have to
the
call
same?
Them all? Where do the farmers, how do you get in touch?
How did you get them, yeah?
Some of them, one was here last year, actually. They had a small market, just one farmer. I just got in contact with him through Department of Health through our contact there. And the others, basically, I frequent farmers markets, and I just went up and said, "Hey, you know, do you guys have a Wednesday market? Are you interested?" Just signed people up that way.
You mean you just got off your ass and did something?
Yeah, that's sick.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Was this just you, or was there a group? I mean, you literally were like, "We need to do something," and you sought it out. I mean, are you the founder of the whole concept?
No. I was actually brought in to just work on the outreach and managing the market and getting the EBT program going so people can use their public benefit cards to shop for fresh vegetables.
Public benefit card meaning, is that food stamps?
Yeah, the food stamp card.
Wow. And there's a little thing, and then it's like almost an ATM. You get reimbursed by the city? By the national government to based off whatever they spent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we get that comes back in. It's like just essentially like a debit card. People get a certain amount each month, and there's also a promotion with
interesting
with Department of Health where they get these health bucks, So when people spend, like every $5 they spend with the EBT card, the food stamp card, then they get these coupons for that can only be used for fresh fruits and vegetables. So like $2 coupons. So basically you get a lot of buy-in power for, you know, for your buck.
Wow. So so you sort of buy coupons before you come to the market, like at sort of a stand. And so there's no cash exchange with the farmer, but later on you sort of figure that out, you know, who bought what with the receipts, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So how's the response been? I know we talked on the phone, it's been about a couple weeks now, very recent, right? 2 weeks.
Yeah.
How's the response been?
It's been good. Yeah, I think most of the people that come through and the outreach that we've done, that there's sort of a sense of relief, like, you know, it's great that I don't have to go to Union Square now, or I don't have, you know, for the people that already do frequent the markets, and for other people that just live in the area and pass by, they say, oh, this is so great, I can, you know, I can stop.
Can you buy everything? Can you buy, do you have meats? Do you have a chicken guy? Do you have, I mean, the full spectrum of what, the green market, or are you guys still growing to be the full 360?
Not yet. Yeah, we're still growing. Right now we have Trinity Farm, which they do fruits and vegetables, Roberta's. They sell their bread.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, tell us the products.
I was at the first Roberta's Bread Farmers Market, which was in Bedford Avenue.
Really?
I sold a couple of weekends.
They're fantastic. I mean, the bread here is unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's Dick Bessie, you know, also a food friend.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm a fan of foods that I think have, you can count the ingredients on your hand. And I think the bread they have here, it's like flour, salt, water. I think that's it.
And the water from New York is fantastic. I mean, it's among
makes
the
best. Makes good beer, makes good bread.
Yeah, I always say that, but I mean, honestly, it's among the best. It really is. I don't know why here, but it really is. I mean, they have the real deal. And they know
terroir.
Yeah, and it's, you know, 30 seconds to 5 minutes in the oven, depending on what they're making, a pizza or bread, but it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So what kind of, so we have vegetables and we have bread. What else we have at the market?
We have another bakery called Cafe 7A. They're also local bakers. They're based out of Clinton Hill, and they do cakes and cookies and those sorts of things. And we also have Red Jacket Orchards. And they're, apples and different apple products.
Wait, do they have Macintosh? Because that's the best. There's no question. Macintosh.
Probably. Yeah, they have everything. Yeah.
I don't know anything but Macs. I know. I'm a total New York State guy.
What are your rules? I mean, do you have to be the farmer? Do you have to be within driving distance? I mean, or are you pretty open as long as it's a traceable good source?
As far as the
vendors.
The vendors, they can be... We want mostly to have people that are local farmers from somewhere like upstate or in Long Island that are producers and produce so that it's things that are in season and locally grown. But as far as other vendors, we like to encourage people that are in the neighborhood like Roberta's that they bake their own bread and people like the other bakery. We're also hopefully for next week, just still getting the paperwork together for a local rooftop farm up at Greenpoint, run by a couple friends of mine. So hopefully they'll be out.
So are you guys selling stuff from the community garden at all at the market?
No, not yet.
In the future?
In the future, I'd like to. I think that's sort of a model that I really want to see happen in the future, is that things are, they're farmed here and they're sold here and recycled, composted here and transported by bicycle and just with as little impact as possible. And
it's the future, dude. I mean, especially with the economy. I mean, that's one thing that is true and that will work. Food terrorism. I mean, who knows what a myriad of things could happen.
Terrorism.
Hurting our national terroirs. But
growing. What's wrong with growing your own stuff? How big a space? I'm always amazed that anybody gets anything done in New York. I mean, how much area did you have to? Did you have to like deal with permits or who did? I know you got the Department of Health on board, but I suppose that's a huge thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, most of that was already taken care of with the Department of Health and the garden. They were kind enough, and they work with us to one to promote the market, but to allow us to use the space out in front. And it's a good spot right there. There's a lot of traffic going through Broadway. It's right outside the metro station at Gates, the J. So like people are just kind of spilling out of the subway.
Yeah, tell our listeners how they can get there.
It's on the J subway line.
Yeah.
And what
The Gates Avenue stop.
Gates Avenue. Gates.
Yeah.
And how far is that into New York? I mean, how many stops Manhattan. On the J?
You know, I six, bike everywhere, five. So I
could
tell
answer,
you that.
Good answer.
But that's
probably wait, not wait, too are you far. Wait, are you the guy who's like bothering me with the bike on the subway in rush hour? that you?
No,
good man. It's like, you know, bike or take the subway. Don't do both.
Yeah, exactly. Don't bike on the subway.
Right.
I have a question though that no one's been able to answer, including Michael Pollan, who I once asked. He's like, not enough information yet. But can urban farming, God forbid, we had to become self-sufficient as five boroughs, if all of those empty lots got converted into vertical farming, whatever, is that enough to feed people? Or is that kind of not?
You know, I don't know yet. But that's actually something that I want to find out and that I'm working on trying to do. In addition to the farmers market, which I think is awesome, and that's the beginning of something that... I'm also working with a group called Earth Matter that does composting for, mm-hmm. we work with, Added Value right now with the Red Hook Farm, and we're working with them on a farm in Governor's Island, starting next right. weekend. Actually, we're piloting
Earth
the
Value.
Compost.
Yeah, that's a fantastic program actually. We, mm-hmm. With the students, and they started in Bushwick also, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now they're on Governor's Island. That's a great talk a little bit about that if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're, so Added Value is putting in, or they just put in another farm there. They carted in some, organic compost. And I actually met with some people there
with
yesterday.
Young people from mm-hmm. the city who probably, like Patrick said, I mean, this is very, as you said, very blacktop mm-hmm. and razor wire here. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are people working in the soil, you know,
yeah.
which is fantastic.
Yeah. And I think it's an amazing thing that they're just doing that. They see the open space, and instead of, you know, trying to dig up the soil and seeing what, like how to rework it, they just put it on top and start from there, which mm-hmm. is pretty simple and pretty, pretty great results so far.
Excellent.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Well, I hope you can come back on. I mean, certainly sustainability, farmers markets, local neighborhoods are going to be a huge part of the HRN. And it'd be cool if not just our show, but also the other shows you could come on if it was
appropriate. Friend of the show, Travis.
Yeah. I'd love to.
F-O-S.
Friend of the network.
Friend of
M. Yeah, and thank you for giving an outlet for farmers. I just read something recently that said, you know, it used to be like 1 in 4 or 1 in 10 people lived on a farm. Now it's 1 in 100. Mm-hmm. So the fact that family farms, you know, it's a pretty cool place to be now.
Yeah, it wouldn't be so bad if more urban farms started to, you know, I mean,
what's
it'd be
what does
a,
that mean?
A source of inspiration anyway. Most people are moving to these areas anyway.
Yeah, well, and that's something I think with me personally that I've debated going to farm somewhere, maybe upstate or outside of the city. But I love being in the city. I love New York. So yeah, I want to bring the farm here and do both if I can.
Absolutely. Well, this is an inappropriate side effect, but it's one that we just got.
What is that?
It's the Whacking. Slide whistle.
We're happy to introduce the slide whistle here.
Yes. Oh, and do we have a caller on the line? No. We did have one. God, we are blowing up. Anyway,
we have 1.5 callers
was
today.
That, was
fantastic.
That the debut of the slide whistle?
Yes.
I'm flattered. I'm honored, rather.
You were there. Well, I hope that this is one that we have heard before. I hope your farmer's market...
Takes off.
I hope so too.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks really for bringing fresh eats to Brooklyn, where it's so sorely needed.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
We'll be talking to you again.
I got a rose between my toes from walking barefoot through the hot house to you, pretty baby. I got a torn right near my corn from walking barefoot through the hot house to you. And when I fell into the tomatoes, I seen her heart skip a beat. I knew that love was born when she pulled a torn of the flower out of my feet. I didn't even feel no pain because there wasn't any rain in the sky. Pretty baby, I didn't need no iodine because the sun began to shine upon me. For now my feet feel glad and gay. ever since that lucky day, I got a rose between my toes from walking barefoot through the hot house to you. Feel no pain because there wasn't any rain in the sky, pretty baby. I didn't need no iodine because the sun began to shine upon me. For now my feet feel glad and gay. Ever since that lucky day, I got a rose between my toes from walking barefoot through the hot house to you.
They take apart their nightmares and they leave them by the door. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks of bed on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. And send me off to bed forevermore. I guess daisies I have to do. Just get me to New Orleans and paint shadows on the pews. Turn the spit on that pig and kick the drum and let me down. Put my clarinet beneath your bed till I get back in town. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks or better on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. So send me off to bed forevermore. Just make sure she's all in calico and the color of a doll. Wave the flag on Cadillac Day and a skillet on the wall. Cut me a switch, oh, hold your breath till the sun goes down. Write my name on the hood, send me off to another town. Then just let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks or better on a blanket by the stairs. Tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. Will you send me off to bed forevermore? But I lie about my past. Send me off to bed forevermore. Send me off to bed
report to all your local broadcasters. We're going to go over as usual because we just can't get it all into an hour.
There's too much quality.
Yeah. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins. If it's Sunday, it's a Q report.
It is, and we're talking about Fresh Eats. Q is for Quotidien. We didn't mention that. Do we need to mention Edwards, our fantastic sponsors, and Vias? Are they still? Do they still care about us?
Yes, they still care. They should.
We love
Vias.
Yes.
But Edwards is our prosciutto guy, and we're going to have a few new sponsors. Anoop and I have been working, so don't be surprised if you see a new logo on the site.
And we have a guest on the line. We're very happy to have Marie Abaya. Marie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Murray.
Murray, thank you. We're late. I'm sorry. Thank you for standing by the phone. How are you?
That's all right. There's so much to talk about.
Is the food that you've been waiting to eat less fresh now because you've been waiting so long?
It is lunchtime here.
Marie is calling from... Marie, are you technically in Albuquerque?
Yes, I am right in Albuquerque, yeah, downtown.
It's a beautiful place. Marie is... tell us about what you do, Marie. Marie is a designer extraordinaire. She's designed at Ralph Lauren bags. She designed New Balance shoes. And now you're designing things of the earth, right, Marie?
That's right. I changed from the fashion world to the natural world, and I do gardens and landscapes. I do art-friendly, dog-friendly gardens.
What's a dog-friendly garden?
Using principles to make sure that your dog and your garden get along, and your dog doesn't ruin your plants and has his or her own place to play. and, you know, there's a lot of concepts you can use, so you don't have to keep the dog in a separate area, and you and your best friend can hang out in your garden together.
Can I ask a question? I mean, are there plants that can survive the pee of dogs? And I ask that because I'm born and raised in New York City, where people put all this effort.
Patrick's a big dog person.
Yeah. And I can't not let them pee there because, I mean, when my dog's going to pee, I got to let him do it. But sometimes it's on flowers. I mean, does that automatically always kill them?
Not automatically, but it'd be hard to withstand. There is there's a new kind of ground cover that we're using in our community park that's supposed to resist dog urine. I don't know what the name of it is, but, you know, it's something specialized that you would, you know, ask for from the nursery.
We have Marie on the line today to talk to her about her community garden that she participates in. But, Marie, I wanted to ask you also about... landscaping and landscape design in specifically New Mexico. One thing I love about it, are you putting in lawns? Do people demand for you to put in lawns? Because to me that's so crazy. But of course, New Mexico has a very wide-ranging climate. So tell us about that regarding dogs and parks. And there's a lot of sand, or am I not thinking of it in the right way?
We have all different kinds of soil here because we're near the river and we're right, you know, going straight up to the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
It's very dry. We have about 10 inches of rainfall a year.
Wow.
So water is obviously an issue much more here and much earlier here than it was, you know, on the East Coast, which, is, of course, it's an issue now.
Mm.
People still ask for lawns, and design is a service business, so, you know,
right.
I have to make my clients happy, but what I try to do is educate them and tell them about the alternative, about native grass lawns that can survive on our annual precipitation.
Yeah.
With, you know, after they're established, and they're gorgeous. They look so beautiful.
Yeah.
And people think they have to resort to gravel to save water, but that actually increases the heat.
Interesting.
So we want to just add in a lot of xeric plants and, you know, go for a natural lawn.
Yeah, and the natural lawn or the natural grasses will hold the soil that it's meant to be in anyway. I mean, you don't have to really bring in anything new. I'm sure that's a big, probably,
draw
for them.
That's a huge issue that people kind of ignore here, is that it's very windy, it's very dry, we have a lot of dust and dirt blowing, and, you know, we want to try to keep that down.
So in that climate, and Marie, we also have Travis Tench here sitting in with us, who is organizing the farmer's market here in Bushwick, very industrial area. But tell us about a community garden and what you have to deal with in Albuquerque with those conditions. Tell us about how you formed it and why you formed it and how it's working for you guys.
Okay. Two women approached their neighbor not far from where I live and said, you have this yard that's not, nothing's happening here, and we would like to start a community garden. And the generous neighbor said, of course, what a wonderful idea. And it's been going for about 3 years.
Wow.
And there's a group of about 6 regulars, up to 10 people that get together, and there is no formal way it operates at all. We plant whatever we want. We kind of have a general organization, you know, because we want to put our tomatoes somewhere different than we did last year. And we try to get together every 2 weeks during the growing season and do some work together and then have a potluck. And it's just been a great community builder. And we have some delicious tomatoes and chard and garlic that, you know, obviously we're very proud of and love eating.
Is it different now? If you have a certain palate, originally you're a Texas girl, of course, but you were in the East for a while and you moved to New Mexico. How's the soil? Did you have to bring in soil? Like, how difficult is it for people living in wherever they're living if they want to have a community garden? You know, what are the things they have to think about?
Well, like the farmers market guy said, a lot of times the soil, you don't know what it is. And
right.
A couple blocks away from our garden is another garden that's a true community garden where people rent a plot.
Mm.
And the water is supplied and paid for by their fee,
mm-hmm.
and they just come and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those were raised beds. Initially, we built them up with straw bales, and now they did a more permanent situation as they got more funding and got more established. So they just brought in all new soil. In our garden, we had good soil. We're near the river. But, of course, we just added a ton of compost, and we keep doing that. And we try to use a natural native way of keeping the water in, and we did beds that are dug down. I don't know if you've heard of the waffle beds that they've used in the Southwest.
No, I don't know what that is. Tell us what that is.
It's imagine a waffle,
mm-hmm.
and you have these scoops that are dug down into the earth, so the water... It stays moist. It doesn't dry out as quickly.
Mm.
There's no runoff. So we had raised paths, and we dug our beds down. And so then naturally the water goes into those areas.
Mm.
And we use straw mulch and other mulch. Mulch is really important here. I mean, we have to use our water wisely, and we also want to make sure that it just doesn't evaporate.
Right. It's a big concern there. So tell us, we only have about a minute left, Marie,
yeah.
but tell us about... you know, tell us that sort of, if you can, in about when you started to where you are now. Like, has the food improved, the flavor? Tell us a little bit about that.
We were all pretty much novices, and
mm-hmm.
it's an experiment, and no one should be afraid of failing. So we've tried different things. We've moved our crops around. One thing we're doing this season that we didn't do before is doing this kind of crowded planting method where we put in a lot of flowers, of course, to attract pollinators,
mm.
but also to give the ground and the plants some shade, which is
right.
so needed here.
Right, of course.
And so we don't have to put a shade cloth over.
Right.
We have our flowers naturally giving the plants relief in the hot afternoon sun.
Just two quick questions left. Tell us, how big a plot of land are we talking about, and has it helped your food bills at all?
It's not a very big plot at all. I think it might be 20 by 40
mm-hmm.
feet.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely, you know, I never buy a tomato in the store.
Wow.
And, you know, there's a lot of ways that we've shared about, you know, canning and keeping the food for when we don't have any produce in the garden.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. So you're storing it up. That's fantastic.
Well, that's again, self-sufficiency is the big thing, you know.
Right.
And it seems like we have so trusted these mega conglomerates. We so took it for granted that our food was coming from a good place. It's pretty inspiring to talk to Renato, Anya, Travis, now Marie, and really learn all about these alternatives, which aren't really alternatives. They're kind of the standard.
Back to the past, right?
Only in the
back
past
to the future.
40 years, these scumbag white boardrooms in Texas have led to us eating food that kills us. And it's really inspiring what you guys are all doing. So I hope you come back as a guest, Marie.
Thank you. I would love to.
Yeah, Marie, thank you for taking your time today on Sunday. And I guess, are we back?
Remember, if it's Sunday, it's the Q Report, Marie. don't let Meet the Press tell you otherwise.
You know what they're going to say.
We'll be back in 1 second.
Great.
I fall down drunk. I I dig you.
Wow, well, poor Doily is like, why are they 10 minutes over? I have a baby. Why are they 10 minutes? It's hot. Yeah.
We're always 10 minutes over. We're early, actually.
But it's always okay to wait if we are squaring, a.k.a. doubling our Marabellas. Which I think we're doing, right?
Yes, at least.
Hello.
Hello,
Miss Marabella.
My cousin, my favorite cousin. I don't have any cousins except for Faith. And your sister.
And my sister.
Yeah. But this is Faith Marabella from Methuen, Massachusetts.
Yes.
And we have to say, Patrick, it's Faith's birthday today also.
Oh, my God. Well, happy birthday.
Well, thank you, my.
Do we have a sound effect? It's your birthday. It's your birthday.
So I'm getting my 15 seconds of fame right here on my birthday.
It's actually going to be 6 minutes.
Yeah. It's going to be more, too, because we'll probably have you back, Faith. So tell us, if you've been listening to the show, I don't know, but we've been talking about local food, and we had Slow Food International, and, of course, Patrick was very involved in Slow Food USA, and... Travis just left the studio, but he organized a farmer's market, and my friend Marie in New Mexico, who is working in a community garden, but you actually are a participant, as I visited you for 4th of July, as you informed me, which I was one of the fantastic, you're a fantastic guest at your very generous home with Patrick and eating those delicious berries from your CSA. Tell us a little bit, what does that mean? I mean, tell us what a CSA is if people don't know.
CSA is a community-supported agriculture program, so the CSA. And I've been wanting to get into one forever, so I'm very new to the movement. Mm. And it sort of fell in my lap that I knew somebody who was starting one up. And she's very local. She's 5 minutes away. And so I jumped on board and bought into a share, which is great. And from people who had done it before, too, to know that to buy into a share, you get just massive amounts of fresh produce that's locally grown. And she is purely organic, too. I don't know if all of them are, but she is. Mm. And so it's organic produce. Basically delivered to, we get it delivered to our door once a week.
And where is this?
This is, pardon? Yeah,
give her a plug. Give the farmer a plug.
Oh, great. Yeah. I was hoping I could. Her name is Caroline Zook, and she's with Sage of Farm in Dracut, Massachusetts. So she's just 5 minutes down the road from me.
Does she have a website or anything for people who are listening in Massachusetts?
Yes, she does. Yeah, it's sageoffarm.com. That's S-A-J-A. FARM.com.
And I don't know if you heard Anya talking about it earlier, but she defined a CSA, which we thought was pretty clear, as a subscription versus a newsstand. So you said, meaning like the farmer's market versus the CSA. So so essentially you have a subscription with five other members that you went in with your neighbors and talked a little bit about that. Sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it was really great. And I was glad that Caroline had told me, you know, you'll want to split it with a lot of other people because she started her season early. And the first time came, there was only four of us. And we had like, you know, 12 heads of mustard greens. And we're like, how do you eat 12 heads of mustard greens in 1 week? So we added some people in and was able to, you know, we were able to stretch it out a little bit more. And it's always fun to find out what you're going to get from week to week. You just,
As long as it's not all one thing. I mean, how is the growing climate of Massachusetts? I mean, are you often able to get a healthy array?
Last week we had gotten strawberries and cherries, so that was a great surprise.
Yeah, I was so happy for that.
Yeah, and then the week before we had like an abundance of herbs. We had a lot of cilantro and chives coming and, you know, some mint. And there was always, you know, some green. We get a lot of... right now we're getting romaine and some of the red lettuces that are coming in and the tender Boston lettuces. So we started with the hardier greens, things that you would normally, you know, wilt, and then, you know, some like bok choy type of greens, tat soy. And half the fun is getting stuff and going, you know, oh, you know, what is this? I wouldn't normally have bought it. Going on the internet as the wonderful tool that it is and finding recipes and just trying stuff out.
I mean, if you don't subscribe, you don't get the paper every day. I mean, you'd like to think that you will discipline yourself, but unless it's delivered to your door, you know that you have to go to some street corner and pick it up. It's just hard to commit to it.
Right. And this really does, it was funny. She was talking about trying to cater a little bit, about giving people a little bit more or less of these things that she wanted. And I said, you know, I love the challenge. I love seeing what shows up. I loved it. I love the fact that I'm going to get this diversity of what's locally available. Now,
you guys are very funny, actually. I love you're like Patrick, get on the horn, like get online, see what we can make with this stuff, you know. And Patrick, you know, so Patrick was figuring out then, like, what else we have, what other ingredients, Patrick, your husband, what other ingredients you have in the house, which was
right.
It's very fun, it's very fresh, it's very local, it's as it should be, right? It's like,
yeah.
And of course, summer in Massachusetts, it's very rich. It's, I mean, you guys have a great diversity of produce, and talk about the eggs, which are absolutely fantastic.
Oh, and this is, I don't know if all CSAs do this, but this is the wonderful, she's grown these hens from chicks, and they're on the farm, they're free range, they eat all organic, and, you know, and all of us in the group will just say, put on our order for the eggs for the week, and she will deliver us a dozen eggs. I mean, it's remarkably cheap. I think it's like $3 a dozen, that fresh eggs that she's harvested that day.
It's incredible.
I never thought getting involved in a CSA would be, especially in this economic times. I mean, the subscription pays for itself, you know, three times over already by the amount that we get, as if we were going, you know, to the store and purchasing things individually. Mm-hmm. It's just...
And you know where it's coming from. And if, you know, somebody's having a party, you can sort of, you know, you can figure out who's getting what that week. I mean, that's
and
nice.
You've aligned yourself with the farmer. There's no better way to show, put your money where your mouth is than to say, I'm in it with you, because I don't want to see that area get paved up.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Because once it gets paved, it never goes back.
That's absolutely right.
There's no going back after that.
Yeah. So.
When are you coming to New York? When can you be a guest here? We need to see you. We need the Marabella Row.
Throw some dates at me. I'd love to come down. That'd be wonderful.
You could do a show or two, and you know, we would provide you lunch.
Okay.
We would provide you drinks.
Oh, well, thank
lovely.
You.
Lovely. Here at Roberta's in Bushwick.
You could see Doily again and get an update on the pregnancy.
Hey, that would be great. And given that your show's on Sunday, I'll have a couple of bags of CSA produce with me, because I wouldn't want it to be sitting here doing nothing in the meantime.
That's true.
Yeah, if it's Sunday, it's the Q report.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Well, thanks so much for being on, Miss Marabella.
We appreciate you staying, and sorry for being late. We're always late. You know, this is our best late plans.
Okay.
Doily was late.
Thank you
six
for
months
having
ago.
Me. You made my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Take care.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, it's been a great Q report. And
so next week, Patrick, we have libations.
Let's get Steve Hindy in.
Microbrews.
Garrett Oliver, Steve Indy, 6 point guys. We'll get some good guys. We'll put Katie on that.
And I don't know if anybody's aware of it, but Brooklyn was, as they called it, Milwaukee of the East.
Absolutely.
That it was a center for brewing. And in many ways, Brooklyn Brewery brought it back.
What? No. Oh,
yeah? And I don't know if that was Jack.
That was Jack. Mentioned. Jack, God, what are you saying?
And Ed Grant, we say hello to Ed Grant.
Yeah, who's no longer with the network.
No longer with the network, but Ed, we say hello if you're listening at home, and I hope you have it back at some point.
Hold on, I have a... oh, wait, that wasn't the right one.
What happened?
I don't know. But right. Anyway,
well, we'll be back, and
we will be back.
Following us, maybe the .com report is coming at some point in August at 2 o'clock.
The network would be better for it. Well, anyway, have a great week, and we will talk to you soon.
Great, thanks, everybody.
For those of you listening right now, be sure and stay tuned for Cutting the Curd on at 3:30 Eastern Standard Time. Fingers.